Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Did you know the United States sells more military weapons to more countries than anybody else in the world? We'll explain how that works on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Battelle. Every day, the people of Battelle apply science and technology to solving what matters most. More at Battelle.org. And by ClearFit. Used by growing businesses, ClearFit is designed to make it easy to find and hire employees that succeed. More at ClearFit.com.
In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Good to have you here on the 12th of August, everybody. It is a Tuesday. The Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel, said something interesting today. The American government, Hagel said, and this is a quote, is working with the Iraqi government to get military equipment to Kurdish forces in the north of Iraq. Left unsaid was exactly how that's happening. Does the Pentagon just ship stuff from storage? Does it write a check to, I don't know, Lockheed, say, and have it shipped on over? And what about when it's not a government that needs the military help, but something like the Peshmerga, the Kurdish militia? How do the guns get where they are going? Marketplace's David Gura starts us off.
The U.S. government does have options. Todd Harrison is with the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments.
There are a number of ways. It depends on how quickly and how quietly we want to arm them.
One way is above board. Many countries effectively write checks for weapons payable to the U.S. of A. The government shoulders the risk. Douglas Ollivant is a fellow with the New America Foundation. He says the Defense Department works with the State Department and lawmakers get involved.
It's all there. It's all transparent. Then, of course, there are other agencies who do things differently.
Ollivant is referring to one agency in particular, the Central Intelligence Agency. Stephen Biddle teaches international affairs at George Washington University.
Normally speaking, the Defense Department deals with governments and the CIA deals with non-state actors.
The Pentagon regularly brokers weapons deals with other state governments. That includes the Iraqi central government. But Iraqi Kurdistan is an autonomous region. So the Defense Department, Biddle says, may not want to deal with a militia.
As far as we can tell, yes, the CIA is now committed to provide weapons and ammunition directly to the Peshmerga.
That has been widely reported, but a CIA spokesman declined Marketplace's request for comment. Biddle says if the CIA is involved, it does have the wherewithal to get weapons from U.S. allies, even from international weapons dealers. Todd Harrison with the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments says we're talking about weapons that are probably worth a few $100 million. In all likelihood, the CIA has money set aside to pay for stuff like this. But Harrison says there's no way to know how much.
We can't see directly what the CIA receives in terms of its total budget.
So no top line figure even?
Not that I'm aware of.
The Defense Department also has some budgetary flexibility. It has $85 billion for what are called overseas contingency operations. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
On to geopolitical hotspot number two now, Ukraine. A Russian convoy left the Moscow area bound for rebel-held eastern Ukraine today. A convoy loaded, the Russian government says, with humanitarian aid supplies. There is some skepticism, it is fair to say, from Western governments about that last bit. Meanwhile, the Polish government is really hoping you've got a hankering for some of their apples. Warsaw has asked Washington to buy Polish produce now that Vladimir Putin's sanctions have cut off its key export market. Those Russian sanctions have left all European farmers, in fact, with a little bit of a headache. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Last year, Europe sold $16 billion worth of food to Russia, 12 times what the US supplied. Peter Kendall, a British farming industry spokesman, worries the EU is losing one of its best customers for milk, butter and cheese.
Taking a market that takes 300,000 tons of dairy products from the European Union, this could have really very, very damaging impacts.
European farmers will struggle to sell their surplus produce abroad. The US, Australia and other countries that export to Russia have also been sanctioned and they'll have their own surpluses to sell. British pig farmer Jim Leavesley is bracing himself for an influx of foreign pork.
If you have something like a 5% extra supply into a market, this can have a devastating effect upon the whole of the price paid across the whole of the European herd.
Consumers may relish lower prices, but, warns meat industry spokesman Mick Sloyan, farmers have to make a living.
They stop producing if prices go too low, and then subsequently prices rocket. So seeing prices going up and down all over the place really isn't in the interest of consumers.
But a tried and tested solution is at hand. This week, the European Commission unveiled plans to prop up peach farmers affected by the Russian sanctions. The EU will buy 10% of their crop and withdraw it from sale. Peach mountains and milk lakes are looming. Europe could soon be adding to its agricultural reserves. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
At the corner of Wall Street and Broad in Lower Manhattan today, things finished just about even. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. What with stockbrokers and financial planners and investment advisors, there are a whole lot of people out there who will happily tell you what you ought to be doing with your money. But sometimes it's hard to tell advice from a sales pitch. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains.
Usually it's pretty easy to tell when someone just wants your money. The extra complimentary sales girl, telemarketers who bungle your name, car dealers.
Let's finish this up. Just left out a couple of things. Rust proofing.
Rust proofing?
Transport charge, storage surcharge, additional overcharge, finder's fee.
Finder's fee was on the lot.
Yeah, that's right.
But what about financial advisors? William Percy learned the hard way that they don't always have their clients back either. Percy lives in Colorado, but he worked as a phone installer in California until the late 90s. Before he retired, he met with an advisor, and her pitch went something like this.
Hey, don't take your pension and get $1,000 a month. Take this and you can get $2,400 a month.
She sold him on something called a variable annuity. Percy thought he could live off its monthly payments for the rest of his life. But the market turned, the principal shrank, and the fees piled up.
You just didn't realize how quick the money could run out. It wasn't as guaranteed as they said it was.
He didn't find out until later that his advisor was being paid each time she sold someone one of these products.
To me, that was all she looked at, was how many clients she could bring in.
Financial services firms are able to portray themselves as trusted financial advisors.
Barbara Roper is director of investor protection for the Consumer Federation of America.
They're certainly relied on as trusted financial advisors by investors, but many of them simply aren't subject to a requirement to act in the best interests of their investors.
When it comes to retirement planning, Roper says the problem is a few key loopholes in the 1970s Employee Retirement Income Security Act, or ERISA. Loopholes like advisors who give one-off advice don't have to act in the client's best interest, and brokers just have to recommend products that are suitable.
But they can recommend the worst of the suitable products, the one with the highest costs or the poorest performance.
The one that makes the broker the most money. Roper says this can shortchange people tens or even hundreds of thousands in retirement savings. The Department of Labor is planning to propose an update to ERISA in January. Lisa Blyer is with the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association, a trade group. She actually agrees it would be helpful to create a uniform standard for investment advice, but she worries the Department of Labor's update might push firms to cut back on services to less well-off customers.
The negative consequences are potentially so great in terms of not having access to somebody to talk to, not having access to certain investment options.
But as William Percy found out, access isn't everything.
I knew what she told me it was, but there is no way for the layperson to know everything. It's like, you know, when you sign your automobile contract, do you understand everything that's in there?
When it comes to retirement planning, we all need a guide. But more importantly, we need a guide we can trust. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
If you want to get from Moscow out to the Russian east coast, the port city of Vladivostok, yes, you could fly, but what's the fun of that? Better you take the train and really get a taste of things. The Trans-Siberian Railroad runs almost 10,000 kilometers and is still being expanded. Christian Wolmar writes about this most famous of trains in his new book. It's called To the Edge of the World. Mr. Wolmar, good to have you with us.
A pleasure.
What is it that makes this railway different than all the others?
Well, first of all, it's the longest railway in the world, 5,700 miles. But then I think the second thing is the history of it. It's a railway along which wars have been fought. It's a railway that united the biggest country in the world, Russia, and therefore incredibly important.
Yeah, in fact, this thing was started 100 or so years ago, and you say even today it brings geopolitical change and is a vital engine of commerce and all of that.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it was started in 1891 by the Tsarist regime in Russia, and they saw it as a way of bringing Siberia into the fold. Remember, there was really no way of getting to the depths of Siberia until the railway, but it was also very much a political military railway with the idea of establishing Russian rule over not just its own territory of Siberia, but also parts of neighboring China, which was really very weak at the time. So it was both a political project and also a unifying project for Russia itself.
You write about how amazing, and this is a quote actually, the continued efficient operation of the Trans-Siberian Railroad is. And I wonder if it runs well despite the economic chaos that's going on over there and has been for decades now.
Well, that's very interesting. I learned a lot about Russia when I was there. And what you have to understand about Russia is there's no petty capitalism, right? There's no kind of small-scale entrepreneurial spirit like there is in America and over here in Europe. But what there is are big state enterprises that are pretty efficient.
This is the kind of infrastructure project that just couldn't be done today.
Putin has an idea of building a railway up through to the north of Siberia, underneath the Bering Strait, over to Alaska and down to Canada, costed at something like $80 billion at the moment, which is a back-of-envelope calculation. It would be the grand projet to beat all grand projets, you know, but it probably won't happen.
But that also gets us back to the start of this whole thing, which is the value of being an autocratic ruler and just deciding to do something, right?
Yes, I don't think we should go too far down that road, but it is true. The Tsars were an absolute monarchy. They brooked no opposition. They were certainly not democratic, and they spent an awfully high proportion of government money on building the initial Trans-Siberian. And you know what? Again, it probably contributed to the start of communism, because if they'd spent it on building schools and hospitals or projects that were more useful to the ordinary citizens, maybe we wouldn't have got communism.
It is a book called To the Edge of the World by Christian Wolmar. It's a story of the Trans-Siberian Railroad. Mr. Wolmar, thanks very much for your time.
That was a pleasure.
Coming up, chicken or chocolate? Chocolate or chicken?
Literally, I was so hungry I could see them both. And I kind of looked, well, what if you combine those two things?
It's better than you sounds, you guys. Trust me on that one, would you? But first, let's do the numbers. All righty, here you go. The Dow Industrials dropped 9 points today, less than a 10%, 16,560. The NASDAQ slid 12 points. That's about a 0.25%, 43.89. The S&P 500 dribbled 3 points lower, 10% there as well. Ended things at 1933. Handbag maker Kate Spade got clobbered today, dropped 25% after the company warned the gross margins would be weaker than expected for the year. Sharp declines in oil prices drilled exploration companies. Console Energy slid 2.33%. Pioneer Natural Resources dropped 2% as well. Big Oil took a dive too, as long as we're at it. Exxon lost 0.25%. ConocoPhillips lost 0.4%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note up just a touch, 2.44%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Emerald Data Solutions, whose Board Docs web applications are designed to help governing bodies operate more effectively by eliminating paper and streamlining board packet processes. BoardDocs.com. By Progressive, offering policyholders the option to bundle home and auto insurance coverage. Learn more at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. And by Zillow, with homes for sale, historical pricing data, and photos all available on Zillow.com or on their mobile apps. Zillow, find your way home. Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on retail sales for July. Deere & Company is scheduled to release quarterly earnings. And now for a popcorn moment. On August 13, 1942, the curtain went up for the U.S. premiere of Bambi in New York City. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The iPhone 6 will soon be upon us. September, if rumors among the Apple faithful are to be believed. There will be upgrades, of course, and bells and assorted whistles, and quite possibly a big move into healthcare. There are reports today Apple is trying to team up with healthcare providers and app developers to track everything from our blood pressure to how many steps we take every day. And Apple's not the only company interested in that stuff. Marketplace's Queenie Kim explains why healthcare is becoming a hotspot for high tech.
Two of the biggest factors driving tech companies into healthcare are the smartphone, which is basically like a mini computer in your pocket, and the proliferation of cheap sensors.
For example, there's one patch we're using called Vital Connect.
Dean Sawyer is the CEO of Jointly Health,
which is capturing your heart rate, ECG, your respiratory rate, your posture, all from one patch, and it's sending that data now continuously.
Advances in artificial intelligence also make it easier to crunch that data. In Jointly Health's case, it uses that data to predict when patients with chronic illnesses are getting sicker. That way, doctors can treat them before they land in the hospital. Everyone from healthcare providers to insurers love this because hospital treatments are so expensive.
The real opportunity here is really around trying to control healthcare costs.
Michael Chui is a researcher at McKinsey Global Institute, and he says it's the promise of controlling costs that's driving demand for this kind of technology among healthcare providers.
The potential for big data and other technologies to try to control those costs, up to $300 to $400 billion annually is at stake.
And there's just as much money to be made as saved. Dean Sawyer of Jointly Health says his little corner of the market,
what we refer to as the remote patient monitoring space, that is being projected at $18 to $20 billion just over the next 4 or 5 years.
And then there's the job of securing all that data flying around. It's creating a whole nother opportunity for tech companies. In San Francisco, I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
You don't have to actually be in Hollywood to make a blockbuster movie nowadays. New York, Georgia, North Carolina, and a whole bunch of other states have a chunk of that action. But it does come with a price. And in North Carolina, lawmakers are wrangling over whether to continue the tax credits that have helped lure those big movie productions to town. North Carolina Public Radio's Leonita Inge reports.
North Carolina fought hard to get the makers of Iron Man 3 to film here. It was a top-grossing movie last year.
I got a great girl, and occasionally save the world. So why can't I sleep?
Wilmington Mayor Bill Sasso isn't sleeping well either. He worries about the blow his city would take if the state's package of film incentives ended.
And God help us, I hope we can keep it and save it for all of us for many years to come.
Iron Man 3 was filmed in Wilmington, so was the hit television series Under the Dome. Sappho believes subsidies help bring them here, so he wants the state to continue its lucrative 25% tax credit that gives filmmakers up to $20 million in tax refunds. Not everyone in North Carolina agrees.
Tell Raleigh to put North Carolina first, not Hollywood producers. Stop the Hollywood handouts.
An ad from Americans for Prosperity North Carolina, a group that lobbies against excessive government spending. Debate over film industry subsidies is growing nationwide. Kevin Clark is executive director of the Association for Film Commissioners International. He says now is not the time for states to pull the incentives. Filmmaking brings jobs.
They're well-paying jobs. You know, they're usually above what the median income is in the area.
North Carolina, like several other states, has to decide what level of subsidy, if any, is appropriate. In Durham, North Carolina, I'm Leonida Inge for Marketplace.
Burger aficionados among you, by which I mean really dedicated burger aficionados, may have heard of a chain that got its start here in L.A. called Umami Burger. It's in New York and Chicago, Las Vegas, and some other places. Now it is doing well, you could say. So when founder and CEO Adam Fleischman stepped down to do something else, there was some curiosity in foodie circles as to what that might be. And there were some raised eyebrows when the answer turned out to be chocolate fried chicken. What Fleischman hopes will be a Choco Chicken empire, that's the name of the place, Choco Chicken, opened its first restaurant not too long ago, just a couple of blocks from us here in Los Angeles. So, yes, of course, road trip.
Okay, so this is our classic boneless thighs.
Okay.
We decided to go boneless with the thighs so they can eat the whole thing and just dig into it.
It is, it looks like fried chicken except browner.
Exactly.
Yeah? And I've got, I have mashed potatoes, right?
Yeah, white chocolate mashed potatoes and our coleslaw.
I'm sorry, white chocolate mashed potatoes?
Yeah.
Going with those first.
There you go. We add some white chocolate instead of butter to kind of give it a creaminess.
There's a lot of white chocolate in there, man.
And then try the chicken by itself, and then we're going to give you a great dipping sauce we do called the Bee Sting, which is a habanero honey sauce.
Chicken by itself. So these are boneless thighs.
Should be hot.
I may have to have another bite, and also I'm not going to need dinner after this.
Yeah, probably not. Yeah, it doesn't taste super sweet, right?
Well, no. If I didn't know there was chocolate in here,
right,
I would not think there was chocolate in here.
Yeah, and that's kind of the cool thing about it is it sets up an expectation of one thing, but it's really just an elevated version of fried chicken, like a new spin on it, a new recipe that gives it a different flavor than people are used to.
Fleischman's partners Keith Previtt and Sean Robbins are the ones who sold him on the idea of combining chocolate and chicken.
So I am a fried chicken nut. And was up in San Francisco, was with some buddies. I was starving. I was in Dolores Park in the Mission.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, yeah, I should get some mole negro, Oaxacan chocolate chicken. And I thought, my favorite food's fried chicken. And I could literally was so hungry, I could see them both. And I kind of looked, well, what if you combine those two things? And so I told my friends, like, yeah, that sounds pretty insane.
Yeah.
And went to Keith, told him about it. He's a chef. And he, started the recipe process.
Tell me how you came up with this, because it's not, we should say, a mole.
It's not. It has nothing to do with mole whatsoever.
All right, you're pretty emphatic about that.
I am deadly emphatic about it, absolutely.
There will be people who listen to this program and say, dude, man, you're making mole chicken. Shut up.
Yeah, exactly. And when I created, when Sean came up with the, he says, can you do with chocolate and fried chicken? My first thought was, I can see the flavors working. So when I went and developed the recipe, I actually bugged me during the week, and then I finally said, that's it. So I walked into Bristol Farms and light went on. And the recipe you're tasting now is not, it's about 95% of exactly what we did actually that day. So I wanted a fried chicken that was layered in flavors. And everybody sees the chocolate.
I'll give you that.
Yeah.
I'll give you that.
The chocolate works like a rosemary or a sage.
Yeah,
or,
that's exactly it. It's not chocolatey.
That's right. It bounces off. It bounces off the sweet. It bounces off the savory and the spiciness of it.
Why'd you go to Adam then?
So when we came up with this, initially we started raising money, and the reality is, my day job is as a film producer. Neither of us have run restaurants.
And it was like, yeah, we'll try it. We'll see where we end up.
Yeah.
People started sending us money. And I would say the same things. I don't know why you're doing this. This doesn't seem like a good idea to me.
Yeah.
I'm going to lose your money. I don't know how to run a restaurant. And you haven't tried the chicken. All of that seems dumb. And they said, you know, well, we believe in you guys. I'm like, that's a horrible idea.
Yeah.
And one of my friends who wanted to invest, there was a connection to Adam. And he said, hey, can I have this guy who knows restaurants give you a call? I'm like, sure, I'll talk to anyone. 2 minutes later, my phone rings, and it says Umami Group. And I pick up the phone and I hear, hey, buddy, it's Adam Fleischman calling. Tell me about this restaurant. And it's probably the first time in 10 years I was nervous.
Yeah.
And so he and us and Lee Weinberg, our other partner, all met. That was Thursday. On Tuesday, sampled the chicken, took one bite, and said, we're in. And by the end of that week, we were partners.
How long ago was that?
That was exactly 8 months ago. We went from...
That's bananas fast,
right?
That's crazy.
We went from concept, pure concept, nothing concrete, to being fully built out and open in 8 months.
That's insane.
Yeah, it's pretty... And then you look at the, you know, the amount of coverage that just people have sort of taken and run with. So, yeah, it's... I mean, we're pretty happy about that.
How much of that, though, the coverage, including us, honestly...
Right, sure.
Is because it's freaking chocolate and chicken, man. I mean, chicken and waffles I get, chicken and biscuits, but...
I think it's a natural... I mean, it's two things everybody loves, so everybody's intrigued by
saying... Yeah, but I love good beer and spaghetti sauce.
Spaghetti,
so,
exactly.
You know.
I drank beer with spaghetti before.
You know, so have I. But you know what I'm saying.
I mean, I guess my answer to that would be when the New York Times preview came out and they loved it, when the LA Magazine, the LA Times, you know, when people are coming here who have, you know, refined palates and write about food and they're loving it, that's the answer that I think we want.
What's the next item that comes on the menu?
Chocolate mac and cheese will be the next big thing.
Is my 10-year-old going to like that?
Yeah. And then we're also going to add a s'mores bread pudding.
Oh, yeah. Mm. I'd go with that.
Yeah, that's good. Mm. Now, I've already tried that with the marshmallow ice cream.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Yeah, no, it's good.
All right.
Yeah. That's a good one.
Thanks,
Alex. Absolutely. Thanks a lot.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation.com with advanced tools to limit the exposure of private personal information online. Learn more at Reputation.com. By University of Nebraska's Robert B. Daugherty Water for Food Institute, committed to research and innovation to ensure a water and food secure world. waterforfood.nebraska.edu. And by MailChimp. More than 6 million people and businesses around the world use MailChimp to design and send email newsletters. More at MailChimp.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today from the Marketplace desk of what could possibly go wrong. And yes, I know I say that a lot, you guys, but this time I really, really do mean it. From the website Business Insider, this item, a new app called Sup, as in, what's up? Anyway, you send a sup to a friend, and if they accept your sup, it turns on the camera on their phone, and you can see what they are doing for 10 seconds. I can't say this loudly enough. What could possibly go wrong? Am I the only one who thinks that? All right. Anyway, we are done. That is Marketplace on this Tuesday. Today, the Dow off 9 points, less than a 10%. The NASDAQ down 12 points, 0.25%. The S&P 500, 3 points lower, 0.1%. Nancy Fargali is our senior producer of special projects. Lindsay Thomas and Caitlin Esch are on the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producers are Ariana Tobin, Shea Huffman, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you back here tomorrow, everybody. What's up?
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.